This podcast contains the personal stories, opinions, and experiences of its speakers, rather than those of Breast Cancer Now. Welcome to the Breast Cancer Now podcast, providing support and information to anyone affected by breast cancer. I'm Laura Price, and I'm the host of the Breast Cancer Now podcast. I'm a food writer and author, and I live with secondary breast cancer. This episode, we are talking to Emma Campbell, who you may know by her Instagram handle, Limitless M. Emma is an author, a public speaker, and a single mum of four who, like me, is living with secondary breast cancer. She is the host of Open with Emma Campbell, a podcast where she has open-hearted conversations with guests, including TV presenters Gabby Roslin and Denise Welch, and breast cancer survivors and thrivers like Leanne Perro and Carly Musa. Although she goes by the Instagram handle Limitless M, Emma writes honestly about her mental health and reaching her limits. Today we'll be talking about Emma's experience of secondary breast cancer, her friendship with the late Dame Deborah James, and how she keeps going when she feels far from limitless. Emma, thank you so much for joining us on the Breast Cancer Now podcast.
Thank you so much, Laura. It's lovely to be here.
How are you today?
I'm okay today. I did wake up in a bit of a kind of slightly overwhelmed Monday, juggling a lot of plates before 9 o'clock in the morning kind of mood. But I did a bit of a reset, which I'm trying to get better at doing by just doing a few things that help me ground myself a little bit and start again.
Okay, well, maybe we'll talk about that in a bit, because probably lots of people would like to know how to do a reset. So you, like me, were first diagnosed with breast cancer more than a decade ago. Can you start by telling us what your life was like before breast cancer and how that initial diagnosis came about?
My life before was, you know, in the year or so leading up to the diagnosis, was really challenging. So it kind of, I often say, I feel like I was already at a bit of a rock bottom when the diagnosis came along. So in 2009, at the end of 2009, I gave birth to triplets after sort of four-ish years of secondary infertility. I had my lovely eldest son, went through miscarriages, fertility treatment, IVF, and, you know, the miracle, magical news of finding out I was carrying healthy triplets, but also quite overwhelming. And unfortunately, my relationship became more and more fragile. And so throughout the pregnancy, was going through those physical changes, those hormonal changes, but also a very turbulent personal life. So stress levels were extremely high. And when the baby's born, you know, another few months of the reality of the relationship falling apart, managing the babies and all of that. So it was an incredibly difficult time. And then when they were 5 months old, I got my initial diagnosis.
So what happened? Did you find a lump? Did you have different symptoms?
Yeah, so I'd had a lump in my breast for several years, in my right breast, that I'd had checked when my eldest son Jake was about 2.5. I'd had a mammogram. Was told everything was fine, and that lump remained unchanged. And then throughout the course of the pregnancy, again, rather than sort of put on a lot of weight, I actually lost a lot of weight, because I think the babies were kind of just taking what they needed, and also sickness, stress, just sort of running on adrenaline, really. So I was very aware of physical changes. And in the months after the babies were born, I was aware of changes. I was, you know, I'd been expressing around the clock. And I was aware of that lump. It was almost like that lump had gone, but I couldn't feel that small, hard lump anymore. But when I'd be sort of lying in bed at night, and the rare bits of sleep I'd get, so lying on my tummy, I almost felt like I was lying on something. And so the small, hard lump, as it turned out, had become a 5-centimetre tumour. Right. But I think I was in such a heightened state of survival mode that I ignored those changes. I ignored those changes for several months. It was almost like my brain wouldn't let me go there. And it was one night, in the middle of the night, I was feeding one of the babies, 2-3 o'clock in the morning, and I happened to just put my hand under my right arm, and I felt a small, hard lump. And I think that was a real sort of universe-tilting moment of shit. You know, I in that moment, I felt like I knew. And I still took me probably a week or two to ring up the GP, because that's what I've always been very good at, putting things off and burying my head in the sand. But I did ring the GP, and from then on, everything happened very, very quickly. And I got a diagnosis of a 5-centimetre tumour with lymph node involvement.
And what, because obviously you were breastfeeding then, what treat, were you breastfeeding?
I was expressing.
You were expressing,
so I expressed for the first 6 weeks and then it just became and said no. But I was formula, but feeding them sort of constantly, as you can imagine.
So were you then able to have treatment? What treatment were you able to have?
So I was immediately, and you have to forgive me because I can never ever remember the names of those initial full-on breast cancer, you know, people say, oh, the red one or FEC or, you know, but it was nearly 14 years ago, which, you know, what a wonderful thing to be able to say. It was nearly 14 years ago. But I was immediately, it did all happen very quickly. So I started on chemo to shrink the tumour, with the plan being that I'd have the mastectomy and reconstruction. And yet I wasn't feeding the baby, so I was able to just embark on all of that treatment. So life sort of shifted from being this newly single mum looking after a six-year-old and baby triplets in a top floor flat and kind of friends doing a rota of helping me with nappy changes and occasionally sleeping on the sofa, to that mum, that me, and then adding on a diagnosis. And so the sort of the ante upped dramatically, and it just became almost like it went from a small community of friends and family to almost like, I don't live in anything like a village, but it almost felt like everyone then just, you know, word spread, and suddenly I had people from everywhere sort of turning up and helping and just holding me through it.
I mean, no one could do that alone.
No, I mean, it's the strangest thing, because I couldn't have done it without all of the help. There was so much practical help, and I just surrendered to it. You know, we find it hard, don't we, to say yes. It's really hard. We want to hold on to our independence. We don't want to be a burden, in inverted commas. But I remember very early, sort of towards the end of the pregnancy, pre-diagnosis, a good friend of mine who already had four children at that point, and she was going through some baby clothes to give to me. And she said, just if I can say one thing to you, just say yes to every offer of help. And at that point, and that was all about the babies that were coming. And I just never forgot those words. And it became something that, you know, in the months and the years that followed, I said yes. I had to say yes many, 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 many times.
I think that's great advice for anyone who has cancer, anyone who has children, just anyone in general. Yeah. You know, we are, I think perhaps as Brits, we are quite bad at accepting help.
Yeah. So, I mean, I know I might be leaping ahead slightly to a kind of what would you say to someone, but, you know, that kind of question of, you know, what can I do for my best friend who's just had a diagnosis, or my neighbour or my cousin or whatever? It really is, don't wait for them to ask you. Just kind of just offer, or just do things unexpectedly, you know. And I think that's the key difference, because as the one going through it, I don't know about you, but actually ringing up someone, oh, would you mind going to the supermarket for me? I can't make it, or I don't feel well enough to cook dinner. Would you? I don't know about you. I would find that very difficult. Whereas the friends that were saying, look, I'm in the supermarket, I'm going to be driving past your house in half an hour. Oh, yes, please, can you bring, you know, that to me was a real reframe, and it made it much easier to say yes over and over again.
Yeah, and it's a much better thing to do than to say, how can I help? Or what can I do
let
to help?
Me know.
Or let me know if there's anything I can do to help, because you just don't even necessarily know what you need. And yeah, I completely agree with you that I would feel embarrassed to ask a friend to go to the shops for me or to do this or that for me, because I know that they've also got loads of things on their plate. You know, all my friends have got kids, you know, they've got lots of things going on. So take a meal round, or
it's just that it's thinking ahead, and it's just those lovely gestures of, you know, the simplest things. I remember coming home from the hospital one day, and a lady that I'd only hadn't seen for years, you know, she was a prenatal, antenatal baby class. And she'd come in, she'd heard I wasn't well, she'd come in and she'd clean my kitchen, and she'd taken all the dirty, all the bed sheet, you know, the washing away, and she brought it back the next day. And that was just like, you know, you never forget things like that.
That's so lovely. Yeah, that's a really nice one to do. So we've talked about the primary cancer and treatment. When did you find out that the cancer had spread, and how did you get that secondary breast cancer diagnosis?
So I responded incredibly well to the initial treatment. I was told I was cancer-free, and I had every reason to sort of feel that, you know, that was it. It was done. And so those next few years were really about, well, physically, you know, as we do, our bodies, if we're fortunate, are resilient and strong. And I was in my 30s. My my body bounce back. You know, it took a long time, but you restore that physical fitness much quicker than the emotional. And so I've often talked about how devastating the emotional impact was in those sort of 3-4 years that followed, where I was technically kind of fit and well, but inside I was living as though I was dying because my fear was just so amplified all the time. And actually, so 2010 was the initial diagnosis, and then it was coming to the end of 2014, just as I was at the point where my oncologist was saying, right, see you in, you know, a year rather than 6 months or whatever it was. And I was feeling really well, really fit. I was exercising. I was really feeling that life was opening up again, you know. And I developed a redness on my chest. And I put it down to, again, me being the queen of denial. I put it down to, I was doing lots of, I'd started exercising again, you know. I was like, oh, maybe it's my sports bra rubbing, or maybe it's detergent, or maybe it's, you know, am I overdoing it with the push-ups? And so weeks and weeks went by, and the redness and itchiness increased. And there were a few false starts. I was told initially, no, that's fine. You know, secondary wouldn't present like that. And then anyway, just before Christmas 2014, I was told the cancer had come back in my skin, which... You know, I mean, this is a whole big conversation for me, because I'm very sensitive to the terminology around cancer. And of course, the skin is an organ, which means that it's a secondary diagnosis at stage four. But I also sort of hold on to the fact that, OK, the skin is an organ, but in terms of where it still felt like quite a localized recurrence. And it's been confusing for me, because in some ways, obviously, I know it's secondary and it's stage four. But it was also, has felt like a localized recurrence as well, you know? So sometimes I kind of, depending on my mood and my state of mind or where we're at in the time of year and triggers, I can be kind of like, yeah, it's just, you know, it just came back there and then it went away, which kind of it did, you know? So that was in 2014. So I went straight back on, and they couldn't operate. It was still HER2, which was, I think, a good thing in terms of I'd responded very well.
This is Herceptin.
The HER2 positive. So I went straight back on chemo, which then, again, I can't remember the name of those chemos. I didn't lose all my hair. I did the cold cap this time, and I sort of developed a bit of a Bill Bailey, you know, not much hair on top and wispy at the sides, but I held on to it. Chemo was really rough again, but then it segued into the kind of Herceptin, pertuzumab and Herceptin, you know, combination, and I did really well. I mean, I went straight back into kind of remission, no sign of active disease, and remained on that combination every 3 weeks, the sort of, you know, maintenance treatment, I guess, until 2019. And throughout pretty much the whole of 2019, I'd noticed changes in my other breast. And again, I'd ignored them. So really, I feel... I can feel embarrassed by that, and almost, if I'm being really hard on myself, I feel embarrassed to admit that, because I ignored those symptoms, and yet I'm still here doing well. So is that the luck of the draw? But at the same time, I don't in any way kind of gloss over the fact. It's just me being honest about my fear and how that manifests itself, and how I still find it easier to ignore things than immediately get them checked. So by the time I'd spent months noticing changes in the other breast, but because I was still getting examined at the hospital every few months and they weren't really picking up on it, which isn't their fault, but I wasn't pointing anything out, I kind of would just lie there crossing my fingers thinking, well, if they haven't noticed, then I'm not going to say. And again, life was feeling good, and I was so scared of sort of, I wasn't living in a blissful bubble, but I'd, you know, you're just so terrified of going back to that place. So it was at the beginning of 2019 when my bloods had just tipped over the abnormal range. And that's what then, and then I remember breaking down with my oncologist and saying, I knew, and I didn't say anything. And he was so lovely. And he said, it's okay. We'd still be doing the same treatment. I felt real shame, you know, and guilt that other people who were so on it and so brave, braver than me, and immediately picking up that phone and getting things checked and facing those fears were maybe not doing as well, you know.
But of course, you have to remember that you have four children that you are, you know, looking after, and you're just presumably trying to keep your head above water, as most mums are.
Yeah, so. I think it's keeping your head above water and just being, I think, when you haven't been able to get a handle on your fear, that you just go into whatever works for you as a coping strategy. So I'd rather, it's for many, many years, rather live with the internal agony of the niggle, is this something, than just face it head on, you know. Yeah. And that's something I still have to really work with.
And was that another primary breast cancer?
That was, see, this is, again, and I feel like I should know all of this. It's another recurrence, and I don't feel like I ever got a clear, definitive answer. It was still the same HER2. It hadn't mutated, which was great, and it meant that then I had another mastectomy. I went straight onto Kadcyla TDM1, which is what I've been on ever since, and it's worked incredibly well for me. So, and that has felt very manageable, you know. It's very well tolerated for me. Mm-hmm. And I seem to respond to it very quickly. The tumours in my left breast sort of just really shrank and really responded very well. And like I said to you just before we started talking, on the PET scan, I was told I had a tumour in my lung. So I had a mastectomy that year, and I had a partial lobectomy, lung resection or whatever they call it. But by a miracle, that lung tumour turned out to be a benign tumour. So again, it's like, okay, so, you know, that I don't have a definitive answer about whether that was a primary or a... And maybe, again, did I not talk about cognitive impairment of, like, did I not take in what they said? Have I not asked the right person or the right question? Can I face asking it now? Not really.
I think there are lots of grey areas in cancer.
Yeah.
And there's also just so much information to take in, isn't there? And, you know, sometimes we, I guess, just can't process all of it.
And we deal with things the way that we need to at the time. So again, for me, I could sort of go, yeah, I'm just going to think that's a new primary, you know. And because, again, I tried to work so much on my mental wellness around it, but the physical side of it, you know, there are so many incredible voices, for example, online, and that continually advocate for us knowing our bodies and pushing forward. And I've always really struggled with that because of my own, I mean, not being able to walk that talk. So I kind of go quiet on all of that, really. So there's a lot more I probably could know about my disease, I guess. Yeah.
Well, we'll move on to that in a moment about your mindset. But first, I just wanted to say this year, 2024, you'll have been living with secondary breast cancer for 10 years. And I just want to take a moment to say how incredible that is, just to sit here and take it in. Because when you're diagnosed with secondary breast cancer, like you and I know, your immediate thoughts often turn to, I'm going to die. To be sitting here with someone who has been living with that for 10 years and who is, you know, here and quite well, is just something that gives hope to others. So firstly, you know.
Thank you. And that's the thing, you know, if I'm, you know, we all kind of try and find a sense of purpose and make sense of why things have happened. And I can't tell you what that feeling is like for me on a very personal level. God, I'm still here. But also, all I wanted 14 years ago, you know, and then 10 years ago, was that I wanted to know where to look for stories of long-term survival. And that was from day one of my primary diagnosis, because I was so driven by fear. And with the secondary, for me, a secondary diagnosis meant death. I mean, that is what it meant. There was no grey area. Mm. There was no, it was just, and so, you know, that, I remember that day very clearly, that Friday in December. I think it was like Friday the 16th of December or something. And I remember exactly where I was. And it was the darkest, darkest, blackest day. And if I'd known where to look at that point, I think it would have helped, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm you know, I'm lucky, I'm fortunate, if I can just give someone a little bit of, it's like, God, look, she's still here, she's doing okay, you know, yeah. Then that's what a brilliant thing to be able to do.
I listened to another podcast recently with Chris Hallinger talking to Liz O'Riordan. Mm. Chris has lived with secondary breast cancer for nearly 15 years. And she was saying one thought she had was, their story is not your story. Yeah. And I found that really, really helpful because it perhaps sounds unfair on people who, you know, live for a much shorter time with secondary breast cancer. But when you have secondary breast cancer, you need to listen to the stories of people who have survived for much longer. And so, yeah, the more people who, I suppose, survive for longer, the more we can look at for that hope. But to hear their story is not your story, I think just is something that allows you to stop comparing yourself to other people and to believe and to hope that you... Yeah. We'll be okay.
I think the massive difference, I think what's so important to recognise in that is that 10, 15 years ago, because there wasn't the cancer community that there is now, there wasn't the online connections and the way we can see into each other's lives and the differences and the fact that cancer is a word, you know, with 200 different sort of versions of an illness, you know, underneath that cancer umbrella. And whereas for me, 10 years ago, 14 years ago, there were just the scary headlines on the front of the Daily Mail. Or it was the, you know, sitting in the hairdressers and picking up a copy of a magazine and be some tragic story of someone. And that, so that, it was impossible personally to separate yourself from, and they were always obviously the tragic, heartbreaking stories. Whereas now I think, because we have all these incredible, if we're fortunate or if we've made a decision to not even use social media, but to observe the way other people's life, You see that the heartbreak, but you also see the hope, but you also see, yeah, every situation is so, so different. I think that's a really important point. And that's one of the many benefits, I think, of a community like Instagram, a platform like Instagram.
Well, I was going to ask you that. So you originally had your Instagram account M+4, which was
me and the kids
charting your story of motherhood with four children. But a few years ago, you changed it to Limitless M. Why did you pick that name and what does it mean to be limitless?
I picked that name because I'd begun before that third diagnosis, between the second, you know, yeah, before the third diagnosis, I really had reached some really dark mental rock bottoms with my inability to live in the moment, with my inability to the idea of letting myself feel any joy or happiness was terrifying. I didn't feel safe. Nothing felt safe. I, looking in my diary, even though again on paper I was doing really well, but the idea of talking about 3 months' time or 6 months' time, I just was in a permanent state of catastrophic thinking. So when I reached a real rock bottom and I sought some help and I began, you know, some therapy and I began taking a low dose of an antidepressant, and but at the same time really doing a lot of sort of, and I think stepping into that platform, because with the M+4 it was, I was kind of blogging this and that, so I wasn't really, hadn't embraced that space, but I think it really was a kind of rock bottom moment of, I think that shift, and around the shift of that third diagnosis, I started running, which helped hugely. That really was I'd connected with people like, you know, Deborah James and the real, and just seeing how other people were living. And also, I don't know if you might have heard the story I've told quite a lot, so apologies if people have heard it, but what my son said to me on the day of my third diagnosis, which I can quickly share, which
Please
was
do,
a
yeah.
pivotal moment. You know, I'd had the phone call saying, you know, there's tumours in your breast and your lung, and the triplets were in reception. Wherever they were, 5 years ago, I can't remember, they were at school. And Jake, who was 14, 15 at the time, came home from school unexpectedly early. And my dad was sitting there with tears streaming down his face. My husband at the time, you know, it was one of those kind of everyone, you know, it was just one of those grim, grim moments. We're all in shock. Jake arrived home from school, sensed something was wrong, sort of went a bit white. He's very quiet, didn't say much. So I said, right, Jay, let's just go for a little walk. Walked to the common, walked to the cafe, got him a hot chocolate. And I was kind of like, just calmly, just trying to kind of reassure him, explain. And I was sort of veering between being kind of like, it's okay, you know, it's going to be fine. And to then feeling a little bit emotional, but it was just this, and he didn't say much. And as we were walking back, leaving the gate of the common back towards home, he just said, "Mum, you've just got to live like it's not there." And I've shared this many times, but it really was, I can't underestimate how pivotal that moment was. It kind of really did stop me in my tracks, literally and emotionally and spiritually. And it felt like a message from, I've got to live like, I've got to, it was a defining moment of finding a way of diminishing and shrinking mm-hmm. The emotional impact cancer had on me. So I think that tied in with this idea of tapping into my own potential, which I've always believed in. I've always had that kind of, you know, the self-help books teetering by the bedside, but not being able to, not really, obviously clearly not filtering through. I wasn't able to put anything into practice. And then the gratitude element, you know, having reached that peak of just pure terror all the time. And I remember just buying this postcard, you know, and sticking it on my fridge, and it said, "Interrupt thoughts of anxiety with gratitude." And that was, so it all sort of began to tie in at the same time. So that limitless, so it was, yeah, so in a very, a much shorter answer to your question, the limitless M handle came about from, it's not that I think I'm limitless. It's more to serve as a daily reminder to myself and that we all are fundamentally limitless. Doesn't mean there's going to be a happy ever after for everything, but it means that we do have an incredible untapped resilience and potential, and that life can bring joy and it can bring magic, and it is going to be desperately hard at times, but, you know, all just tied in for me. Mm. And it was like taking glasses off. And that's why in the last 4 or 5 years, despite some of the darkest, darkest times, I've got more access to joy now than I've ever had. I mean, I get euphoric over the sort of most tiny things at times because I feel so, so grateful. And that doesn't mean I float around on a cloud. You know, this morning I felt quite low. This weekend felt a little bit flat. Doesn't mean that I'm skipping along. But when I can just have a little bit of a pivot in my mind, and that's my way of coping. Doesn't mean I still don't find it hard to mention things that are niggling me. Doesn't mean that I don't bury my head in the sand. Doesn't mean I don't catastrophize, but I've managed to find a way of turning the volume down, you know.
How do you live like you don't have cancer?
Well, it's, you know, right now in a state as I've been, again, feeling miraculously lucky, that's quite easy to do because I have my 3 weekly targeted chemo, but as far as I'm aware, sitting here this minute, you know, my cancer is, there's no sign of active disease. You know, there's everything's been very, very stable for, yeah, five years nearly, yeah. Which feels like scary to say, but amazing to say. So I haven't had a scan for a long time because, you know, my oncologist sees me every 3 weeks. My blood's remained stable and within normal markers. And so, you know, it doesn't mean the anxiety isn't there in the waiting room. It doesn't mean that I'm, you know, and I celebrated recently, you know, my 99-hundredth-ish cycle as we're talking now of the drug I'm on. And I can have one thought of how amazing, this is incredible, here's to 100 more. Or I can have the other voice that goes, oh, well, that means it's going to stop working. But I had that thought at 10 cycles, 20 cycles, 30 cycles, and I'm very aware of what may and will likely or not happen. But
it's really difficult because I think there's this huge grey area when you have secondary breast cancer. You can have secondary breast cancer and be terminally ill and, you know, very
poor
close
prognosis,
to death, I guess. But you can also have secondary breast cancer and be, as you say, living like you don't have cancer, which you sort of have to reset your whole brain. Because a year and a half ago, I was told I had secondary breast cancer and I was Googling it. And, you know, it was looking like sometimes, you know, you might have a few years to live. You might be less lucky than that. And then my treatment worked and I had an amazing surgery. And now it's like my oncologist says, well, you just live like you're going to live, you know, for a really long time. And you have to reset everything, all your way of thinking and also all those around you because, you know, like you, I've put stuff on social media. And so then people think that you're dying and you sort of have to... think like, you know, every decision I make, I factor in cancer.
Yeah.
So if someone asks me to do something, let's say a job or a long-term project, I will think, can I do that? Do I want to do that? Because I, you know, I might not live as long as someone else might. And it comes into all your decisions in that way. Mm. But at some point, do you start thinking, like you said, I don't have cancer at all, and just make decisions normally?
No, it's... I mean, I and it's funny, and I don't even use the cancer. I don't even use the word cancer doesn't come into my vocabulary again. Not because I'm so above. It's because I still have a lot of attachment to the fear of that word. So I guess the living like it's not there is something that I try to apply to. It's sort of diminishing the attention on the unwanted and just shifting that focus. So it's not so much, I mean, I'm very, very mindful of my vocabulary. So I still find myself thinking, you know, I've been invited to do quite an exciting event abroad in March, which I'm pinching myself at it. How amazing. And I still think, oh, but still the next thought is, will I still be okay in March? Mm. It's not now, will I be here in March? Whereas even years ago, in the primary years,
yeah,
my brain was so, I don't want to say, my brain was so dysregulated, I would go from being, in my mind, from being fit and well to lying in a hospice. There would be no middle ground. It was like, well, dying. Whereas now, I don't think, you know, I think, oh, I hope everything's still okay in March when I, or whenever it might be. So I'm very, very aware that things can change at any point. And never, you know, I'm very fortunate at the moment not to be living within 3 monthly scan windows, but I still find that 3 weekly hospital cycle sometimes very distressing, even if I know rationally that I'm pretty sure I'm doing okay still, you know, because you still, in the week up to that hospital appointment, I feel like my mood sort of dips a bit. I'm a bit more irritable with the kids. I'm a little bit edgy. My treatment's always on a Wednesday at the moment. So I find myself kind of looking at my diary that week thinking, oh, what if my life's changed on that Wednesday night and Thursday looks different? And then I come out of the, skip down the steps on the end of that Wednesday, and I think, oh, I'm feeling this huge kind of appreciation again. And all's well with the world, and then the cycle begins again. And I'm not comparing that at all to someone who's currently living between scans, because that's a whole other, you know, level of extreme emotions. But it's just managing where we are, and also having that compassion to not, you know, because just as friends who haven't experienced, have gone through a cancer diagnosis, will say to us and put their very well-meaning way, tilt their heads and say, oh, but you know, I've been laid down with flu, but oh, it doesn't compare. I'm very aware that I am in this good place. So I'm sensitive and aware of that, but also can't diminish my own, got to be mindful that I don't completely deny my own experience as well, you know.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's not, none of it is all, you know.
It's a lot. We'll go back to talking about social media for a moment, because you've posted a lot about struggling emotionally, and your posts kind of resonate not only with people with breast cancer, but with anyone, you know, with mums, with people going through the menopause, with men, women, single parents. What is your relationship like with social media? Do you use it for support, and do you have to have breaks from it?
The breaks I take are normally when I just think I have nothing of interest to say, and I don't feel, you know, I don't know how to show up unless I can be completely honest. I'm not within reason completely honest, so I'm not very good at, unless I have to post something, you know, the occasional kind of collaboration, I have to post something, so I'll often have bursts of being on all the time and really feeling all the goodness of that platform, and other times I just feel I'm too vulnerable. I do feel that Instagram, for me personally, has been incredibly positive. I mean, you know, we have to watch how addicted we get. And I never want it to be, you know, I try to make my have other things going on. So that if Instagram disappeared tomorrow in terms of work, in terms of anything, then I'd be okay. You know, I don't think it's healthy to just... But I've just made the most incredible connections, like I'm sure you have. I've been fortunate enough never to really have much negativity. I wouldn't... I'm very thin-skinned. I don't think I'd cope if I was getting trolled and getting, you know, I wouldn't want to look on tattle, for example. But for the connections and the understanding and the feeling of... And I suppose I think I do speak my truth. So therefore, if, as in my emotional truth, I'm not confrontational, I don't get into heated, you know, and I... But I speak my emotional truth on there as much as I can. And I don't think that can offend anyone too much, really.
Yeah. And speaking of making connections, you were close friends with Dame Deborah James, who sadly died from bowel cancer in 2022. What did you learn from Debs?
She was a huge part of my mindset shift around that time that I was talking about with the third diagnosis. I remember on the very day that I got the phone call from the oncologist saying that I did have, you know, a new diagnosis. And because they mentioned my lung, Debs was one of the first people that I rang, and I was sort of crying, and she just said, she was very calm, very immediately there for me on the phone, but said, you've got options, right? I can hear her voice now. You've got options, right? It's like, they've given you options. Like, oh yeah, yeah, there are options. Right. And it was just that kind of, and then we went on to see how her, you know, last months played out and those last couple of years. It's like, she just wanted options, and that's what she talked about. And that again has helped that, you know, I can have that in my mind. I can have her voice and wisdom and lived experience in my head alongside my oncologist, who, when I've sat with him crying, weeping, you know, even in the last year or two, where on paper I've been well but emotionally in a terrible state, so very vulnerable in his office, saying, but what if I get again? And he's like, if you do, we'll deal with it, because we can do this and we can do this and we can do this. So she taught me and many of us the importance of just needing to just focus on the step in front, rather than, again, those of us who are prone to the catastrophic, you know, thinking. And also all of the wonderful things about Debs, the obvious, the rebellious hope and the spirit and the ability and the determination to find joy and look for joy and create joy. And that's not something that came naturally to me. Whereas, you know, the spontaneity that she, with how she lived her life, and that's, again, not something, you know, I felt like I always led a very small life because I was scared of a lot or lacking in confidence. And I think over the last few years, I have gone a bit more kind of, fuck it, you know, and you know,
yeah.
It's not the. I think when the world has shaken you to such a point, it doesn't feel like a safe place. And when I never describe my body as having let me down, because I don't want to, but when things have gone awry, where's the firm footing? So life can feel so fundamentally scary. And I think that's, again, something that I'm trying to, that it's safe for me to be happy. Being happy isn't going to trigger a chain of catastrophic events, which is how I think I used to always live.
Yeah.
Even before the cancer.
You sadly also lost your friend Nikki Newman, who co-founded Secondary Sisters, brilliant group.
Yeah.
How do you carry on after a close friend dies from a similar illness to what you
it's
have?
It's been a really tough time. 2023 felt tough. 2022 felt tough. There's a lot. And you know, around the time that Nikki died, those of us who knew her, and even at the funeral, and in the conversations around that time, we were saying this isn't... It was acknowledging the abnormality of living, you know, and I'm not in my 30s anymore. You know, I was a lot older than Nikki was. But that feeling of, even at my age, you know, it's not normal for your friends and close friends, distant friends, to be dying. It's not normal to see another post up, to have another funeral invitation. And we've kind of normalized it because that's the world we're in. But I think that's what I think a few of us have kind of talked about. And again, it's so comforting to be able to say, yeah, you know, reach out and do leave that tearful voice note saying, this is messed up. This isn't normal. This isn't how it's supposed to be. So again, it's devastating, but I think we just... These bright lights that are being taken from us, you know, I think when you've gone through what we've gone through, or we continue to deal with, we have to. It's all a cliche, but we have to take some of what they gave, because otherwise, to not be doing them a disservice, you know, we have to. Mm. You know, my way of giving myself a little kick is going, what would Debs do? What would Nikki be doing right now? You know, Nikki would be looking up at the sky. Okay, it's not a sunny day today as we're talking, but, you know, so I think that's the magic and the very, very, that's the magic of all of this, is that we're able to look at life with an intense appreciation and awareness of what matters.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I mean, that's certainly, I didn't know Nikki well, but no, that's certainly what I took from following her on Instagram, is, you know, an appreciation. And, you know, also when someone sadly dies far younger than the average, it also resets your thinking, doesn't it? To think, oh my God, I need to appreciate what I've got, and the fact that I am here, and, you know, I can drink this cup of tea or read this book or whatever. So yeah, appreciating life. So in 2018, you published your memoir, All That Followed, which was a story of cancer, kids and the fear of leaving too soon. How was the experience of writing that book, and how did you get your publishing deal?
It was a dream come true. It was just a dream come true. I'd always written, but it was very much a kind of a bit of a buried dream. And, you know, I'd been blogging like everyone else was in the years before that. I wasn't really on Instagram at that point. I was writing a column for multiple Parents of Twins and Triplets magazine. I'd briefly had a column in Best magazine, which I always forget about, actually. But so the book came about. It was a real sliding doors sort of bit of a Cinderella moment. I was working at the literary agency where I'm now a client, and I was working on reception, you know, wonderful company, and it was a sort of quiet end of the day on a Thursday, and one of the new literary agents came down and was kind of making conversation on the desk, and my colleague, he said, oh, I need some new clients, and my colleague said, oh, Em's a great writer, you should read her blog. And I sort of was like, you know, probably went bright red because I was so timid at that point and not very good at pushing myself forward. And he was like, oh right, yeah, send me your blog. And I did. He went upstairs, and I remember sending him the link and then sitting there and going, oh, this is, oh, probably just ignore me from now on. And he came down about an hour later. He said, wow, what a story, and you write really well, and why don't you come and have a chat tomorrow. And the next day I went into work and went and had a chat with him, and he said, I really think this could be a book. And he took me on that day, and I wrote, and I was lucky enough to get a book deal. And it was from the happiest. And I haven't written another book since. I've been trying so hard to write another book. I dream of writing a book two and a book three, and I don't know what it is, the resistance. I think I'm scared. I think I don't quite know. That story just needed to come out, so it just tumbled out. Whereas so much has happened again, and there's so much that I probably really couldn't talk about, that whereas I just, that just, it just poured out. It was like a stream of consciousness book, really. And I'm really proud of it. I just hope it's not the one and only. But if it is, I did it.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that you even wrote a book at the same time as dealing with cancer and having four children is pretty amazing in itself, and having other work as well.
I was nothing was going to stop me, because it was a dream come true. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's like.
And what about your brilliant podcast, Open, with Emma Campbell? Tell us about that.
Oh, so that was a wonderful opportunity that came about. And season one launched at the beginning of January 23, and it gave me, everyone does a podcast, and I'd always thought, I'd love to do a podcast, but I wasn't really sure how to begin. And I was approached by two producers who said, look, let's do it. We think you've got a lot to talk about and share. And season five is out, and I just feel it gave me such a lovely focus during 2023, when things were still feeling quite emotionally difficult and challenging. I've found an absolute, even more, it's reinforced that love and passion for conversation and connection, and hearing each other's stories and just holding space and realizing how incredible we all are. And, you know, through the lived experience of whatever we're going through, the wisdom and the nuggets. And so that feels like a real passion. I mean, I have big dreams for the podcast. So, but, you know, what's lovely about it, just like the book, it doesn't really matter, because I'm giving it my all. Those conversations are there forever. And that's also enough, you know.
Who would be your dream guest if you could have literally anyone in the world, realistic or not?
Well, I've just had one of my dream guests, the holistic psychologist, so Dr. Nicole LaPera. And she was on my vision board about a year ago. So I've just recorded with her, which I can't, I'm kind of pinching myself. I mean, someone like Gabor Mate, you know, those real kind of mindset, you know, deep thinkers, I think would be incredible. You know, real conversations about vulnerability, authenticity, but also, Joe Dispenza. No, Joe Dispenza would be my absolute dream. So the neuroscientist and that whole mind-body connection. And he talks a lot about, you know, incredible stories of remission and healing and how it's linked, you know, how the brain can rewire itself. So that should have been my number one. Dr. Joe Dispenza would be my dream podcast
guest.
Okay,
well, we can manifest that for 2024,
on my vision board,
perhaps.
Yeah.
And tell us about that. You mentioned a Monday morning mind reset. What? How does one reset one's mind when we're feeling a bit
I think
off?
It's, and again, recognizing when you just can't. So it might be that you need to kind of just write the day off. You know, I've become quite good at, you know, if I'm really struggling or feeling low, or there's things going on that I feel, or my body's just sort of crying out for rest, I sometimes, my body speaks and just says, just stop, you know, and so I will kind of almost take to my bed. But that's normally, that normally means I'm feeling quite low. But today I was just feeling overwhelmed. I was feeling sort of grumpy, a bit like too much for one person to do, all those kind of domestic things. And I've really learned, it sounds very corny, but I've really learned to look up. You know, my bedroom's in the loft. There's a Velux window. I kind of really make a point of like looking up at the sky. I wasn't feeling, I sort of, my appearance, like hence the ridiculous amount of bright colours I'm wearing today. It's like I've become someone who used to wear a lot of black and a lot of grey. But it might be the social media, Instagram influence of pops of colour. But I think it's important to me that I feel, always makes me feel better if I kind of just make a bit of an effort, or I put the dangly earrings on or the lipstick. It does it. For some people that isn't a thing, but for me, and I know I'm not alone with that, it really does help lift my spirit. It makes me feel stronger and more connected with that limitless side of myself, and makes me feel like a sort of well, vibrant person. And I didn't journal today, but I do a lot of internal thank yous. You know, I kind of, even if I'm washing up, I'll kind of, like you say, the cup of tea, you know, I kind of try to bring it back down to the moment. Mm-hmm. So the present moment of, okay, this minute right now, I'm in my kitchen, it's a mess, but, you know, how lucky am I? And I really don't mean to sound like it's all skipping, you know, I have many internal voices that don't help me and serve me, but I always come back to gratitude. I would like to be doing more running than I'm doing, because that always helps with my mental health. And I can't quite seem to push through that, but yeah, all of those things.
And well, you've mentioned a few bits of advice already, like saying yes to things, which I think is brilliant advice. And you've given some advice to the friends and family of someone with cancer. But if there are any listeners listening today who have perhaps just been diagnosed with cancer, secondary or primary, and who perhaps also have young kids, is there anything you would say to them?
It's hard, because they, you know, anyone is it's going to be feeling how they're feeling. And if it's a very new diagnosis, they're going to be feeling every understandable thought going, which is the worst case scenario, the fear, the what ifs, the shock. And it's recognizing that you're in shock. You know, when that diagnosis comes, you're even if you were kind of half expecting it, you know, that's a moment you're never going to forget, but that moment does change. And I always say, you know, once you get onto the treatment pathway and you know what your routine is, I think that's one positive step where you think, okay, at least I'm on my way now. I always try to, from the very first time, every time I've ever had treatment, I do always, I don't ever want to see that my body's let me down or my body's working against me. I always try to think of my body as being a responder, you know, and really, really having a vision of myself being told how brilliantly I'm doing and how my markers are down and how the tumour's shrunk dramatically, or, you know, how that, you know, when we sit in that chemo ward, which is such a frightening place, but imagining that when you're hooked up to the IV drip, imagining that what some people view as a toxic sort of poison as a bit of a magical kind of, you know, my body, I'm a responder. Mm. My body knows what to do with this drug and this treatment. And then I would say, obviously do all of the obvious physical things of resting and but also anything that just takes you out of those thoughts, any positive distractions, and also really, really believing there will be moments of lightness again. You will have moments where you think, God, this minute, I'm okay this minute, you know, and it's just acknowledging those and trusting that they'll come. And when they do happen, just trying to store them somewhere, yeah. You know. And I think, because I think that's what life is. I think life is a collection of moments, if we're lucky, you know, knowing that in between there's going to be the tricky stuff.
Yeah. And what about talking to kids? I know your triplets were very young when you were first diagnosed, yeah. But you must have had some conversations with all of your children over the years about cancer.
Yeah, with Jake, first time around, Jake was 6. So it was very much kind of, I think, the book, Mummy's Got a Lump or Mummy's Lump. And he was in his Spider-Man costume in the kitchen and, you know, oblivious, but there'd been loads of people kind of around and whispered conversations. And so I sort of said, I began like that. I said, oh, you might have noticed that, you know, you might have noticed us having lots of quiet conversations, or Mummy's got a lump. It's the classic thing. Mummy's got a lump. A nasty lump, I think I said, but the doctors are going to give me some really strong medicine to make the lump go away. Mm. But mummy's going to look a bit silly for a while. I'm going to lose my hair. And it really was like that. It sounds like a sort of textbook script. That was what I said. I remember it exactly. And he just went, okay, Mum, what's for dinner? And then I remember a month or two later when my hair fell out, and I was always, you know, I was always kind of self-conscious about my bald head. I didn't embrace it. And I would sleep in this kind of, when it was shedding, one of those funny little cap things. And I remember one morning him sort of yanking, I was changing the babies on the carpet and he was leaping around and he yanked off this cap and we both sort of shrieked. And I remember feeling really upset because I felt vulnerable. It wasn't his fault. I felt sort of bad for him. And then second time round and third time round, I think, like I said, I told you the story of when he was 15, you know, and his incredible insight and awareness. And with the triplets, they have no recollection, of course, other than having seen photos of me because they were months old first time round. Second time round, again, they were only 4 or 5, so they didn't notice that I'd lost quite a bit of my hair. They were at nursery, in reception. And then 5 years ago, they knew, you know, oh yeah, mummy's, you know, having surgery, she's having cancer treatment. They know, but they, sometimes it's a little, to be totally honest, sometimes it's quite annoying because, you know, they're 14 now and I go to the hospital every 3 weeks and sometimes I'm really knackered and really kind of fed up. And it's like, do you have any idea? You know, I could sometimes do with a little bit more stroking. But no, I think they view it as, I think in a way, I don't know if it's a bit of, not confusion, but I don't think they're very connected with fear of me not being here. And mm. I remember when, because very lucky for them, they've seen their mum living in the long term, still being mum, managing things, looking to all intents and purposes well and kind of okay. And they see me going to the hospital. They see me come back, you know. And I remember when Deborah was, you know, really, really in those last weeks, and she was on the news a lot. And oh, that's your friend, that's Deborah. Oh, is she going to die? And I said, yes, darling. Oh, but I didn't think you died from cancer. Okay. And that was like, wow. They, you know. And then I could think, well, have I not? But I don't feel at this. I don't feel like I've needed to sit them down and say anything. And I'm again very, very lucky that I haven't, and if that day comes then I will. But I'm sure there's buried emotions for them, you mm. know, that will emerge.
Yeah, there's certainly no point trying to put fear in.
Like they don't need to be living with a heightened anxiety. I know that if we find ourselves watching one of the you know, Stand Up to Cancer or one of those, I'll notice a bit of a side eye. And they'll be looking at me and they'll be, but they see me as well.
And I find that when I'm talking to an anonymous audience, so let's say I could share my feelings quite openly sometimes on social media or on this podcast, let's say, but that when I know that close family are looking, sometimes I feel a little bit unsure. Do your kids look at your social media? And when you're sharing really honest opinions about perhaps being very down and depressed, are they aware of that? And do you ever sort of police your thoughts with them in mind?
Yeah, I mean, that's a bit of a sticky issue. So when they were much younger, I would share a lot more of the baby stuff and the kind of, you know, and I guess I was the mum with cancer and the triplets, and it was all a bit more. And obviously, I've become much more mindful of that. They don't want that. And occasionally, one will slip through, like with their recent birthday, and I don't think they've noticed. I've just had to do that reel, you know, because I just kind of want to mark those moments. And occasionally, I'll share them on stories, and then I know it's gone. But I'm very mindful about what goes on the grid. In terms of my emotions, I think they know. They, you know, that the Instagram is something that has led to some... It's been a very positive thing for me. It's also led to some lovely opportunities. So they know that there's a link to, you know, in some ways a working life, in some ways, even just from what it's led to, even if not directly. So I think they've understood that. I'm sharing a humanness, yeah. You know, I'm not revealing too much. I don't think about them or their lives or, you know, and the stuff I do share that might be talking about the challenges of parenting triplets, it will be on a podcast or be on someone else's live. And I think, well, if the day comes when they listen to a podcast, they're still going to hear how much I love them.
Yeah, of course.
You know, I hope.
I would like to ask you the question that we ask all guests on this podcast, which is, if you could see one change in terms of the diagnosis, treatment or recording of breast cancer in the coming years, what would it be?
Gosh, I mean, obviously, it goes without saying that all treatments and all advances available to all. I mean, that just, you know, that's kind of so obvious. I think more examples of people living in the long term, you know, more of the positive stories, not just within our community, but in the media, and kind of, you know, people being represented, you know, as living with what is more and more a chronic disease for many rather than a terminal one. You know, that would be a wonderful change. And I think a more deeply rooted belief that life can still continue and be big and full of possibility and expansion despite what on paper can seem grim.
Yeah, that would certainly help. Give a lot more hope to others. So thank you for that. And how can people find you? Where can people find you if they'd like to know more about you?
So on Instagram, as you said, Limitless M, my podcast Open, and they're the two main sources, I think.
And Open is on all the
platforms. The usual platforms, yeah.
And we'll put the link in the show notes well, of course. Emma, thank you so much for joining us on the Breast Cancer Now podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you. It's been a joy.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Breast Cancer Now podcast, make sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please also leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts and perhaps recommend it to someone you think would find it helpful. The more people we can reach, the more we can get Breast Cancer Now's vital resources to those who need them. You can find support and information on our website, breastcancernow.org, and you can follow Breast Cancer Now on social media at Breast Cancer Now. All the links mentioned in this episode are listed in the show notes in your podcast app. Thank you for listening to the Breast Cancer Now podcast.